You know how to book flights and hotels. All you're missing is a tool to plan the travel experiences you'll have once you arrive. That's why you need Viator. Book guided tours, excursions, and more in one place. There are over 300,000 travel experiences to choose from, so you can find something for everyone. And Viator offers free cancellation and 24/7 customer support for worry-free travel. Download the Viator app now and use code Viator10 for 10% off your first booking in the app. Find travel experiences for you. Do more with Viator.
This episode of the James Bond A to Z podcast was recorded before we heard some interesting news about the James Bond ownership. Brendan, what did we find out this week about James Bond?
Well, it slowly and then rapidly unraveled that Amazon were in talks to acquire MGM, and that did actually finalise this week for $8.45 billion. So exciting times for the franchise.
Interesting news. We weren't expecting that, were we?
No. That'll teach us for not talking about only talking about things from the 60s.
Yeah. So, as I mentioned, we did know this when we recorded this episode, but expect us to be discussing it more in future podcasts. So, back on with the show.
Hello, I'm Tom Butler.
I'm Brendan Duffy.
And I'm Tom Wheatley.
And you're listening to the James Bond A to Z podcast.
Join us as three lifelong 007 fans go on a journey of discovery.
We're on a mission to discover everything we can about cinema's greatest spy films.
By learning about the people who made them, in front of the camera and behind. The James Bond A to Z podcast is in no way affiliated with James Bond, Eon or the Fleming Estate. We've researched each episode as extensively as we can, but our information does come from a range of sources. We do our best to make sure the information is accurate, but sometimes we can get it wrong. If you want to correct us on something or add some more detail, email us at podcast@jamesbondatoz.co.uk.
You are listening to the James Bond A to Z podcast, and it's another episode in the letter C. My name is Tom. I'm joined again by Brendan and Toddler Tom.
Hello.
It's another varied show, lots of different people to talk about from lots of different fields within the James Bond universe. If you haven't listened before, we basically go through basically an encyclopedic dive into the world of the Bond films, and we cover a bunch of different things in each episode. This episode we'll be talking about some villains from Octopussy, an editor, a writer, a stunt driver, a film studio, and then a character from the Roger Moore era. So it's quite an eclectic show this week.
Exciting.
C is for circus twins. It's a bit of a random one because, actually a bit of a cheat because they're not called the circus twins. They're called Mishka and Grishka. But there's no surname given, so we're calling them the circus twins, and they are a couple of henchmen from the film Octopussy. You guys remember these?
Very well, yeah.
They
big,
wear the...
Big fan.
Yeah, they're in Octopussy's circus and they wear the maroon puffy shirts with the leather waistcoats.
Yeah.
So they are played by real-life twins David and Anthony Mayer. They're British actors. In the film, Kamal Khan and General Orlov employ the pair as assassins, and I don't know if you remember this film very well, but like the start of the film, you see, after the post credits, you see Agent 009, who is disguised as a circus clown, and he steals a fake Fabergé egg from Octopussy's circus while it's in East Berlin. And then Mishka and Grishka give chase. It's actually really quite a chilling scene. I don't know if, because
yeah, it's a bit weird. There's a few scenes. Is this the one where there's dogs chasing?
Possibly. Yeah. Because Agent 009 is dressed as a clown.
Yeah.
So it's got a weird like atmosphere to it, and you don't know that there's twins until the very last minute. He's being chased by one, and then the other one like appears right in front of him.
Yeah. It's quite they're an interesting pair. Octopussy seems to be defined by ridiculously niche villains, because I seem to remember these guys, they're knife throwers, aren't they, basically?
Yeah.
So every sort of death they cause is got to have something to do with throwing a knife, even if it's not the most efficient way to do it. I remember there's another character in Octopussy who can only kill people by standing
I think it must be about 2 meters above them and dropping a like yo-yo saw on them.
Yeah.
Which doesn't really work if you're stood on the same level as them. So it's they're quite limited villains.
It's a strange film for the villains, really. Orlov, obviously, he's a very over-the-top villain. You've got Kamal Khan, who's very sort of measured. You've got these two. It's a bit of a strange film. But yeah, the circus twins, as we're calling them. So they kill 009, like I say, throwing a knife into his back. And it's that murder of 009 and the recovery of the fake Fabergé egg, because he manages to deliver it to the British embassy. That's where the dogs come in, and he falls through the window, I don't know if you remember, and it's quite a good scene. And that brings Bond into the story, and he sort of starts investigating Octopussy's circus from there. So yeah, but later on in the film, Bond kills Mishka while in the train sequence. He drops a circus cannon on his head, seems to kill him instantly. And then later on, there's a bit of a chase on top of the train, and Bond and Grishka get thrown off the train. Grishka pins Bond to the wall with his throwing knives, and then Bond kicks the door open that he's pinned to. Grishka falls through, and then Bond throws a knife into his stomach. It's quite a grisly death, actually, for James Bond. According to reports, and I haven't been able to find much more information from this, but the origins of Mishka and Grishka came from an early script for The Spy Who Loved Me. I haven't been able to verify much more information beyond that, but that's where they came from. And there was also the original idea for them had or Cubby's concept for them. He'd actually seen some French nightclub act who might have been knife throwers as well, and he really wanted them to be in the script. He really wanted them to be in the film. They had like this big bouffant hair, and hence why the characters ended up having bouffant hair. But they decided they didn't want to be in the film because they didn't want to be murdered in the film for whatever reason. Mm-hmm. So anyway, they had to find these actors to play them after these circus acts decided not to do it. Anyway, so Tony and David Mayer, they're born in 1947 in Watford, so they're British. They made their film debut in Hamlet in 1976. They describe it as a student film, and they play two sides of Hamlet. It's quite an interesting concept, the light and the dark, a bit like Gollum, if you can imagine, in Lord of the Rings. Also appearing in the film was Quentin Crisp, Helen Mirren, and Vladak Shebal, who was Kronstein in From Russia With Love. Mm-hmm. And actually, when they made that film, they were quite excited that they were in a film with a James Bond actor. But before that, they'd mainly done sort of Fringe and Rep Theatre. So they're very much like thespians, actors, rather than film actors. Their first shared acting credit, from what I understand, came in a film called The Third Walker, which was a 1978 Canadian film. And that also starred William Shatner. And it's about twins who get separated at birth and are raised by different families. And so that was their big sort of break. But there's a really good interview online with them, for Bond fans only. It's a fan site. And they say they're talking about this film. They said nobody saw it, but it was a good experience for them. So like I said, Cubby had seen a nightclub act and wanted to hire them, but they didn't want to do it. And then they basically, this is according to Anthony and David, they said they looked at bouncers, taxi drivers, models, and then eventually actors to play Mishka and Grishka. And they said the process was that we had to go in and put these wigs on, read for them and look villainous. And then they went on and did knife throwing exercises. But the wigs was quite funny for them because, well, it just doesn't add anything to the character. And I would have assumed that it was their real hair.
That's the only reason why you'd have it.
Well, exactly. But yeah. So they're in the film, like, not a great deal, but they make quite an impression, I think. There's the scene that I've already mentioned. There's a fight on top of a train, and that was filmed at Nene Valley Railway. And David, who played the second twin, the one that didn't get murdered on by the cannon, he did a lot of the stunt work himself on top of the train, and he called it one of the most exciting things he'd ever done. So Roger Moore and Kabir Bedi were, as Gobinda, they were fighting on top of the train, and they needed to be able to show at least one face in close up on top of the train, but Roger Moore and Kabir Bedi didn't do it. So David ended up doing it, doing the close ups. So it's quite interesting.
Mm-hmm.
So talking about what it was like to work with Roger, David said he was delightful. He was so relaxed that you relaxed. And they also talked about Cubby as well. Obviously, Cubby Broccoli, the producer of the films. He said, Cubby was very nice too. I had the temerity to say to Cubby with my scene where I tried to kill Roger Moore. He said, I read it and I couldn't see it was going to be any good. And Cubby replied, well, you know, a lot of the films don't look so good on paper. So they didn't, being in a Bond film didn't really have a huge impact on their careers. It didn't catapult them to fame. He said they got a few adverts after it. They got toothpaste commercial, chewing gum commercial. But the thing that they really enjoyed after being in Bond was something called Peter Greenaway's The Draftsman's Contract. Peter Greenaway is quite an acclaimed director, but this was his feature debut, and they got to star in that, and they sort of considered that to be their pinnacle of their acting career. David is much more of the active actor now, and has got loads of credits to his name. He's been in Inspector Morse and The Bill. And in most recent years, he was in the 2015 miniseries London Spy by Tom Rob Smith. I don't know if you saw that.
No.
Had Ben Whishaw in it and Edward Holcroft, Jim Broadbent. And David actually worked for many years at the Globe Theatre. He was very instrumental in getting that built in London. Actually, they're both really well known for being a very, very famous production of A Midsummer Night's Dream. Peter Brooks is A Midsummer Night's Dream. And this is, like, if you read on anything about Midsummer Night's Dream, this is considered one of the iconic versions of it. So they're both in that. Tony also is still acting, but he's also been an art director. He's into painting and he's also done teaching as well. So, yeah, they're, like, not massively active on the Bond circuit, but they've done their stints, they've done reunions, yep. They've done bits and bobs here and there, but yeah, they don't really see it as being a huge part of their lives being in Bond, but it's definitely something that they've sort of come back to. They say it's like a high school reunion, you just go back and it's like, oh yeah, nice to see you and blah blah blah. But yeah, that's it, the Circus Twins, David and Tony Meyer. But yeah, I would recommend checking out this interview they did for Bond Fans Only. It's quite an enlightening, they're quite a funny pair actually. That's it.
C is for Clark, Jim Clark. So Jim Clark was a film editor. He was born in 1931 in Britain. He grew up in, this is one for you two, in Boston, Lincolnshire.
Ooh.
Yeah, and then he went on to study in Northamptonshire. So he's connecting all three of us there, geographically. And he founded the Oundle Film Society in 1947 as well. Don't know if that's still going, but you know, it's something, you know, something that shows the intent that he's interested in film from an early age.
Yeah.
So his most sort of recognised films will be Midnight Cowboy. Have you seen that?
Oh yes.
Yeah. Yeah. So he was a creative consultant on that. So he sort of went and did a bit of rework on it because it was unreleasable at the first cut, and so he went in and he completely recut it, added the song Everybody's Talking. And, you know, turned it round, basically. Marathon Man, so he edited Marathon Man as well. Killing Fields and Vera Drake, so they're what are considered his main body of work. He started his career on an Ealing comedy called The Titfield Thunderbolt. Either of you seen that?
Yeah, I've heard of that.
Yeah, so that was in 1951, and then he graduated to assistant editor by the time that they'd finished shooting that. He's also dabbled in directing as well. Every Home Should Have One in 1970, Rent a Dick in 1972, and Madhouse in 1974. Now, the first two are those classic British, what's the best way to put them? Like, you know, like the sort of like Carry On, I guess. Yeah. And then Madhouse is like a horror. And then he works with Michael Apted in 1979's Agatha. So this is laying the groundwork for how he connects to the Bond world. He worked again with Michael Apted in 1994 on a film called Nell, which actually received 3 Golden Globe Award nominations and an Academy Award nomination. I've not seen it, but...
Jodie Foster?
Yep. Yeah. Have you seen it?
I haven't
any
seen
good?
It. No.
Nope.
I've seen clips of it. It's quite it seems quite amusing.
Oh, really?
Because she plays a feral woman, right? Who sort of...
Mm.
Anyway, it's easily spoofed.
Yeah, we talked about it quite a bit when we did the Uptead one, didn't we?
Then in 1999, he is given the task of editing The World Is Not Enough, which was directed by Michael Apted. And he said, somehow I never thought I'd end up editing a James Bond movie. I realised how far they had come since the days of Connery. Very polished, high-gloss techno yarns. The thought of attaching myself to such a venture was slightly awesome. Not being accustomed to editing action movies, but therein lay the fun. So, as we sort of discussed the direction on The World Is Not Enough, but also I guess that goes with the editing as well. It's at times the pace is sort of reined in a bit, and it's not as action driven. So I guess that's lends well to his style of editing. Nice bit of serendipity. The following film he edited was actually called Kiss Kiss Bang Bang, which of course is the term for in the 1960s that referred to Bond, specifically during Thunderball. So I just thought that was nice, you know, that his next one was also Bond related in theme. And then his last significant works were Vera Drake, which I mentioned earlier, in 2004, and Happy Go Lucky in 2008 was his very last piece of work.
Oh, Mike Lee.
Mike Lee, yeah. Well, it's very enjoyable.
Great film.
Yeah. And he said, looking back over many years, the American cinema of the 40s was very important to me, along with Hitchcock films and early British comedies. Music has always played a major role. It influences the rhythm of my editing. The pacing of a film and its dialogue have a lot to do with the music. And the act of going from one shot to another has always fascinated me. When and how you do it, the reason for an edit. So, yeah, he was very passionate about what he did. And I guess it's good that he had a David Arnold soundtrack to sort of influence his rhythm as well.
That's a real long career that he had.
Absolutely. Yeah, that's...
When was the Titfield Thunderbolt? Was that
1951.
Wow.
To 2008. Over
50 years. He must have seen some real changes over the years.
Mm. He mentioned, didn't he, with the... He didn't realise how much James Bond had moved on in 35 years. So, yeah. There we go. That's Jim Clark.
Must be quite hard to edit. Because it's not like writing, is it? The changes in technology make editing a very different task throughout the years.
I think the process is very the way that the digital editors work is very modelled on the old fashioned cut and splice of the old days. I think if you look at like someone like Thelma Shoemaker, she's been editing for Martin Scorsese for years and years, and it's one of those jobs that it's a journeyman job, isn't it? You can just do it forever.
I suppose if there's any career that you will develop as the technology develops, it's probably editing, isn't it? Because you'll just pick the things up as they come along, like little slight changes, and you'll learn how to do that because it'll make things quicker.
And it's not a physically demanding role either. Obviously it's a mentally demanding role, but it's not one that you're lugging cameras around on set or having to expend all your energy on set. You can just sit in a dark room. It's probably a great job for an old person, isn't it?
yeah.
Cup of tea when you like. Jim Clark.
It's Jim Clark.
In all due respect is due. Well done.
C is for Clement. Dick Clement. So Dick Clement is a writer who, he's not got a big part to play in the Bond film series, but his role is as an uncredited writer on Never Say Never Again. And that's it, really. So his dad work with Bond is just working on that film. But he has got a really interesting history in the industry that goes on for quite a long time. So I'll go into a bit of depth of who he is and what he's done in his career. And then I'll talk a little bit about Never Say Never Again, although there's not a lot of information about what he's done on the film. So he was born in 1937. He's an English writer, and he's associated quite heavily with another writer called Ian Le Frenais, who is as a duo. They worked on loads and loads of different series and films over the years, and they're kind of peak period was in the mid 1960s onwards, where they wrote a lot of stuff for TV series like The Likely Lads, Whatever Happened to the Likely Lads, Porridge, Lovejoy, Auf Wiedersehen, Pet. And they've also worked on a few films as well, but not too many. And the earlier ones I've never really heard of. So The Jokers, Otley, and Hannibal Brooks. They're the early films they've done. I've not heard of any of those. So Dick Clement's early career, he kind of started working with the BBC as a studio manager, started getting involved in writing scripts and comedy sketches, and became involved in a few various series. One of them was called Not Only But Also, which was Peter Cook and Dudley Moore series. He's done various other things as well. He did a rockumentary called To Rush It with Elton. But really, the career is defined by these kind of TV sitcom series that they did, to the point where they actually went over to California to work on a series called On the Rocks, which is the US version of Porridge, which I didn't know about whilst I was reading this. They also worked on a film called Prisoner of Zendar, which starred Peter Sellers. So yeah, they went over there and it wasn't very successful. On the Rocks, as you probably imagine, have you seen it? Did you know it existed?
No.
I mentioned it to one of our friends, to Stubbs earlier, Butler, and he was like, "Oh, don't talk to me about that." So he's big fan of Porridge, not so keen on the Rocks. They also did a film which you might have heard of called Vice Versa, which is a brilliant film with Judge Reinhold and Fred Savage. Is it Fred Savage or is it the other Savage?
Is it a body swap thing?
Yeah, it's him and his son. And they swap. It's basically the same concept as every other body swap film that came around in the 70s and 80s. But he wrote that. They worked on a load of American shows as well. So Tracy Takes On, which is a Tracy Emin comedy show which ran for 4 years. And they also have uncredited roles, writing roles on The Rock, which obviously has a link to Bond. Pearl Harbor. And they did a television adaptation for Rob Harris's Archangel, which starred Daniel Craig for BBC One. Thought that was interesting. They were both awarded an OBE in 2007 honours list as well. So, well done, guys. Now, when it comes to Bond, as I said, there's not really a lot of information about what they did on Never Say Never Again. I tried to find some interviews and things that where they talk about it, and there's a little bit of information about it. But the interesting thing that I found out was that Tom Mankiewicz, Connery wanted Tom Mankiewicz to polish the screenplay for Never Say Never Again, but he declined because obviously he's got his links with Cubby and didn't want to work on this kind of alternative Bond world. Probably didn't want to annoy Cubby. So Connery got Dick Clement and Ian Frenese to get involved instead. And apparently that was quite common. There was a lot of uncredited writers that worked on Never Say Never Again. Always seems to be the way with these secondary Bond films that aren't really in canon, that they get a lot of script writers in to kind of fix them up. Apparently Francis Ford Coppola was associated with Never Say Never Again at some point. I don't know if he's actually, any of what he did was in the finished version, but he was one of the uncredited writers on there. Interesting bit of information about the work that Clement did on Never Say Never Again. He used some scenes from Porridge in Never Say Never Again. So there's a scene in Porridge where Fletcher is undergoing a medical examination and somebody asks him to fill a flask. And then he says, "What, from here?" And then that scene is recycled in Never Say Never Again with Connery doing it, although apparently not as well as Fletcher in Porridge. There's also another scene where Bond and Felix I couldn't remember this scene. I tried to find it on YouTube and I don't think it really exists, and I didn't want to watch the film to find it. But there's a scene where there's a getaway and Felix and Connery...
They strip off.
Sorry?
They strip off and escape on the bike.
Yes, they play a boxer and a trainer escaping, which is a copy of Porridge as well. So
oh
these little
God.
Bits that come
How
from
How interesting.
Yeah. There's a book, which I'd never heard of. I don't know if you've heard of this, called Battle for Bond, The Genesis of Cinema's Greatest Hero.
Yeah.
Looks like a great book, but it's the only thing I could find that had any sort of information about Dick Clement and what he'd said about the Bond films. And in it, he talks a little bit about Never Say Never Again and how it was a really difficult film to work on. And he says that they had these kind of terrible rows in the evenings after shooting about the day. Quite a long quote, but it's the last thing I've got on Dick Clement, so enjoy. At the end of each day, there was a huge debate about what was going wrong. And my writing partner, Ian Lafrenaise, and I would sit in on those meetings until they started to get ugly. And then we would get up and say, we'll just go and make the dinner reservations. So we would go and get a bottle of red wine, start drinking it, and wait to see who turned up. And it tended to be Sean. He'd come in and say, bloody Mickey Mouse outfit, and grumble at us. He found it very unprofessional. So there you go. Dick Clement.
I think they were, he would, it was Connery who brought them in, I think.
Yes.
I think he was obviously very keen to work with them and wasn't happy with the way that it was going, as you can tell.
Yeah.
But interesting that they recycled some porridge stuff. That's really funny.
Yeah, I'm assuming that Sean Connery, because Connery would have known those series really well, being British. He would have. That's probably why he got them in. So he maybe wanted that sort of British humour to come in on it, which was probably a staple of a lot of the Moore films as well. So at that point in time, probably something that he wanted. But yeah, definitely, I never knew that there were those scenes that that replicated porridge in it. But yeah, definitely interesting to know. Dick Clement.
C is for Collins, Ben Collins. Ben Collins, born 1975, he's a racing driver from Bristol in England, and he has driven cars in four James Bond films, Quantum of Solace, Skyfall, Spectre, and No Time to Die. Famously, was also the Stig on Top Gear from 2003 to 2010, and since then he's become very well known for what they call precision driving in films. Other blockbusters he's driven in include The Dark Knight Rises, Solo, A Star Wars Story, Jack Ryan, Mission Impossible, and actually quite recently he had an acting role in Ford v Ferrari, the Le Mans 66 film, which I think is a great movie, the James Mangold movie. He played the role of Denny Hume and also did stunt driving in there. So let's just talk a bit about Ben before we jump into Bond. So he was born in Bristol, spent the first 10 years of his life in California because his father worked there. And that he talks about his first time behind a wheel. He said, I started at age 4, I guess, is my first vehicular experience on a very small John Deere tractor, which I crashed into chicken fencing because I just couldn't drive. My legs weren't long enough to reach the brake pedals. He went to school and then went to study law at the University of Exeter, and then he joined the British Army and spent some time as a driving instructor for the Special Forces. And then he started his racing career in 1994. His racing career is huge, and I could go on about it for hours, but like, there's just too much to talk about. So let's just say he had a very, very good racing career. He did Formula Vauxhall Junior, he did Formula 3, Indy Lights, Formula 3, tested M1, F1 cars. He did all sorts of stuff.
So basically, I've got no idea what the difference is between those.
Well, they're just different types of racing, aren't they? He's done Le Mans, he's done like basically every type of racing there was. But he said getting into stunt driving, he said, was a painful experience. In 2007, I was racing in Romania in a qualifying session and I took pole position. I broke all my ribs when I got hit into the barrier by a guy behind me. So the car was a write-off. I had to get peeled out, and it was probably £500,000 worth of kit, this car. He said, I was out of racing for a few months, but I could still do the precision driving. And it was, and obviously he'd already been doing that on Top Gear, but he said that it was just a happy coincidence that I got called up to do a Nicolas Cage movie, and it just went from there. So that Nicolas Cage movie was National Treasure.
Great film.
Yeah. I mean, do you know the story about him being the Stig on Top Gear? I don't even know if I need to go into that.
I don't know anything about it.
Well, there was another Stig before him who wore the black suit. And then he basically got outed to the press. And so they had to get rid of him and bring one in a white suit. And I think that was Ben Collins. And then Ben Collins was writing his autobiography while he was on Top Gear. And details of it were part of some sort of lawsuit, and so then that got leaked to the press that he was the new Stig, and then he basically got fired from Top Gear.
The whole point of Stig is that you don't know who he is.
Yeah, well, I guess, yeah, sorry, if you haven't watched Top Gear, the idea of the Stig is he's their trained racing driver, but he's completely anonymous. The idea was, I believe, because the first guy that did it wasn't very good on camera and wasn't very confident talking. He was a great racing driver, but not very good on camera. So they just said, we'll just make him anonymous. And then it just became a thing. And I think the term the Stig is a public school thing, because Jeremy Clarkson obviously is, you know, I don't know. It's something to do with posh schools, basically. It's the person that you get that gets bullied in posh schools.
Right.
But anyway, why does he need to be anonymous? That's what I don't understand.
Well, I don't know. I guess they just kept it up as a ruse, and now become a part of the show, hasn't it?
People love it. I never understood. I remember at uni people had posters of the Stig, and I was like, it's not even a person. It's just an outfit.
It's Ben Collins.
Oh, yeah. Now I know. I would have got one myself.
So he then left racing driving, became a precision driver, which is what they do in, you know, when they need someone to drive really specifically for a film. So he was a precision driver in 2008's Quantum of Solace, and Collins actually drove James Bond's Aston Martin DBS as a stunt double for Daniel Craig. So there's pictures of him, and he's got his hair blonde, and he's got Daniel Craig's suit on. So he's talking about the film. They were assembling a team of experts for what was billed as the biggest opening sequence in Bond film history, with a visceral car chase followed by a bloody rooftop pursuit. The locations, vehicles and stunt crew were handpicked to guarantee action, and the driving needed to put audiences on the edge of their seats, which is where I came in. My first call every morning was at 5:45 a.m. with the costume and makeup department for 45 minutes of hair bashing and metamorphosing. I climbed into a Tom Ford suit that was customised for Daniel Craig, put on the Ocean Seamaster watch, and I remember thinking I had a lot to live up to. Awaiting us on the set were no fewer than 12 Aston Martin DBS for Bond, worth $240,000 apiece, as well as 6 Alfa Romeos and a fleet of nondescript background cars. He says, yeah, basically that was it then. I mean, that opening sequence of Quantum of Solace is fantastic.
Oh, yeah. Definitely.
It's definitely the highlight of that film. It's brutal. It's action-packed. Mm-hmm. He said
that, I know, we turn up after that.
Yeah. He he said that when they were he was watching them beating up the cars to make them camera-ready, because obviously it gets really smashed up, that car. He said he had to look away because he couldn't watch them hammering this Aston Martin. He said it just felt too sacrilegious. But this is quite interesting. Talking about that scene, he said that it was heavily edited down. He said it was heavily edited down, but it was the most brutal and realistic car chase I've ever done. It makes my hair stand up on the back of my neck because I remember what it was like to make it. So the scene is only 3.5 minutes long, but actually it was supposed to be much longer and actually took 3 months to film. Wow. Collins said it was originally 20 minutes long. It really had legs, and that's the way it goes. Editing is brutal. I would love to watch the full-length version. So that's interesting that Quantum of Solace, a film we talked about last week, being edited, and it turns out that it might have been a much different opening sequence.
Yeah. When we get around to doing Quantum of Solace, there's a lot to talk about with that film, isn't there? What I find interesting with that is that all of the stuff around Quantum of Solace is that we're talking about the writer's strikes, but it sounds like there's lots of other issues involved as well that aren't even associated with writers.
No. I guess it all starts with the written word, doesn't it? So if it's not in place, then...
I would have thought that they would have lent more on... They would have put a lot more stuff in that wasn't written.
Yeah.
To pad it out, but it sounds like...
But maybe it just felt it went on for too long. But yeah, that's a film that's like the shortest James Bond film. So to think that they cut it down is quite interesting. So Collins returned to work as a stunt driver on Skyfall and Spectre. Skyfall obviously opens with the chase scene in Istanbul in Turkey. They were doing a lot of driving between streets, and it meant that they couldn't... So often with filming, they would put the car on a trailer and tow the car, and then the actors can sit in the car and look like they're driving. But because the streets were so narrow, they couldn't tow the car. So they developed this thing called the pod system. I don't know if you've seen that. But basically, it's a stunt vehicle, and it's got a one-man roll cage welded to the roof. So then Collins sits on top of the car and drives the car while the actor sits inside the car and pretends to drive. So it looks like they're driving, but actually it's someone sat on the roof of the car driving. Yeah. It's quite amazing. And so I think he did the driving for Naomi Harris in that scene. So yeah, down below the actor can sit inside the car. I imagine that's terrifying, being sat in a car and having a race car driver driving it and then you not having control over it.
Roger absolutely wouldn't have been awful up for that.
No. Roger would have green screened it, definitely.
I'm bad enough just being a normal passenger. That's just, yeah. No, not for me.
Yeah, Ben says the pod thing is what we use to make things as real as possible. And then he also drove the DB5, the iconic DB5 in Skyfall. He called it hallowed ground. He said the first one I drove, it had Bond's old radar system, from Goldfinger. It had the gear stick with the flick switch for the ejector seat. He says it's a fabulous car. It's a beautiful drive, really smooth and equally powerful. So that's interesting. Obviously, we did a whole episode on Aston Martin and we talked about the DB5. But interesting that was fully gadgeted up, that one that he got to drive. So,
yeah.
He said he didn't take it easy on the car, though. He said he just drove it the way it was supposed to be driven. So that was Skyfall. There's not much information about what he did in Spectre. Obviously, Spectre's got that great chase sequence in Rome, the one that I saw being filmed. I didn't see Ben Collins on set then. I think Daniel's got a different stunt driver then. Now, I can't remember what his name is. But yeah, I don't think he doubles for Daniel anymore. But yeah, talking about Daniel Craig and if he's the best Bond, Ben Collins said, I think he genuinely is. I think he's a fantastic Bond. My other favourite was Roger Moore, completely different for different reasons. I love the comedy element. A favourite movie of mine was A View to a Kill, which had that awesome intro with the snowboarding.
Sounds like you need to get him on.
Yeah.
Oh, no.
It was back in the days when they used to love a bit of humour with the Beach Boys song and when you've got that mad car chase through Paris where the car gets split in half. Yeah. So, I mean,
That's what we're saying, that there's a time and a place for Bond films. And if you were in that era, that's what you wanted. That's why they made them like that.
Yeah, true. So he's going to be behind the wheel again for No Time to Die. Not sure what his involvement is because he doesn't double for Daniel anymore, but I think there's a lot of chases in that film, I'm sure.
Yeah.
He's actually just published a new book called Aston Martin Made in Britain, so I think that's one to look out for if you're interested in those cars and that world. I think it's got the DB5 on the front cover. But yeah, that's Ben Collins.
C is for Columbia Pictures. So, Columbia Pictures, you will have heard of them, I imagine, if you've seen a film.
Yeah, I've heard of them, yeah. Yeah. I think I've seen one of their films.
Yeah. Yeah, they're a film studio, production company, distribution company, and they're part of Sony Entertainment, the Sony Pictures Group. I'm going to do a brief rattle-through of highlights of their history. I'm not going to go into
too much
depth.
Yeah, don't feel you need to bring out the board report.
I'm not... So it was founded in 1918. It was originally called Cohn Brandt Cohn Film Sales by two brothers, Jack and Harry Cohn and Joe Brandt. And then they released their first feature film August 1922, so nearly 100 years ago. They adopted Columbia Pictures in 1924. It's derived from the national sort of personification of the United States, which is Columbia, and that is also used as the logo, which is based on the Statue of Liberty. So that's another thing that's iconic. When that comes on screen, you know it's a Columbia. Mm-hmm. So I'm going to skip forward to the 60s. They actually turned down Cubby Broccoli's offer with Eon to produce and distribute the films, instead going later on to make Casino Royale, which we covered.
We've drawn a line at this.
No, I'm sorry, it's cropped up again. So if you remember, we did mention in that episode they were struggling financially at that point and were throwing all their eggs in a basket regarding this, with a budget of $6 million to begin with, which then spiraled out of control to $12 million, which please see the Casino Royale episode for why it spiraled out of control. So, yeah, they then sort of made a bit of a comeback. I think that was by taking on the TV part of their production company, which sort of kept them afloat and got them back. Then in 1982, they were actually bought by Coca-Cola. So that's pretty interesting. I didn't know Coca-Cola owned a production company, but yeah. But then They sold it to Sony in 1989, so it doesn't seem like they were that interested. But interestingly, in 1986, a guy called David Putnam became head of Columbus Studios for a year. It didn't go very well because he was too sort of inward thinking. The projects he wanted to go really small scale, low budget, so it didn't work. But he hired Jim Clark to be his vice president at Columbia Pictures. Please see Jim Clark earlier in this episode.
just remember.
And because he valued his overall movie sense, and beyond his editing, he had a feel for film. So he brought him on board, and Jim did say, people do come to me for advice on scripts and looking at cuts and seeing films and advising and commenting. So that was another short stint, so less than a year, but it's, you know, another link. And then in the 90s, if you're sick of hearing of Casino Royale, I'm sick of hearing Kevin McClory's name. Oh. So, yeah, Columbia announced plans to create a rival James Bond franchise because they owned the rights of Casino Royale. So they planned to make a third version of Thunderball with Kevin McClory. But this led, and we will cover this, I'm sure, in greater detail. But this,
again,
how many episodes are we going to do on McClory?
I think most episodes. So then they sued Sony Pictures, MGM and Dan Jack in 1997. And I think we have mentioned this legal dispute that sort of the rights were then settled for $10 million and the Spider-Man rights. If you remember, we talked about that.
Yeah, Casino Royale.
I don't think we've gone into detail with it.
Yeah. Well, when we get to Spider-Man, we'll cover that. So, yeah, they then got Spider-Man, which is something else that sort of fragments another franchise. So in 2006, they finished first place in terms of the takings with $1.7 billion. And that was down to the success of films Da Vinci Code, Pursuit of Happiness, Open Season, and Casino Royale. So Casino Royale was the first of a four-film contract for them to co-distribute the series. So all of the Daniel Craig films prior to No Time to Die, they're all distributed by Columbia. In 2012, Sony announced that Columbia had passed $4 billion worldwide. And that was down to Spider-Man, 21 Jump Street, Men in Black 3.
21 Jump Street?
21 Jump Street, yeah. Huge. Hotel Transylvania and of course, Skyfall. So, you know, Bond, more recently, I mean, I bet they feel like fools giving it up in the 60s, not going for it, not taking it on. But the last four have been absolutely huge for them financially. And now, obviously, with No Time to Die, it got put out to tender again, just to a one-film contract. So it'll be Universal that will be distributing that. But yeah, that's Columbia's part to play. So they've sort of always been there, present in the background, you know.
Such a messy... The Bond series is such a messy ownership, isn't it?
Mm. Oh, there's worse ones out there. There are much worse ones out there. The Terminator one is an absolute joke. That's had so many distributors and companies behind it. But yeah, I mean, Columbia, I guess the thing... They brought him into the 21st century, right? The films, they very much have a very specific marketing style, and way of doing things, which for those four Daniel Craig films before No Time to Die did gangbusters for the series, I guess. Mm. So can't overlook their impact on the series. Universal have been dealt a bum hand. I bet they thought they were quids in when they landed the No Time to Die, but
yeah.
Yeah, and where it'll land next, who knows?
Yeah. Mm. Maybe MGM Columbia will come back. Who knows?
Place your bets.
Yeah.
C is for Columbo. Milos Columbo. So, Milos Columbo, he is the... Well, he plays a baddie in For Your Eyes Only, but he also, by the end, plays a goodie as well. He's part of the big twist in that script. He plays a Greek smuggler who is a rival of Aris Christastos, who is, as you remember, the actual baddie in For Your Eyes Only. And interestingly, he's based on a character called Enrico Columbo from Risico, which I didn't know before researching this.
That's a Bond short story.
Bond short story. Which book's Risico in? I can't remember.
Is it an Octopussy? I can't remember.
I think it might be Octopussy, yeah. But that's not all. He was also apparently named after a man called Giacchino Colombo, who was a Ferrari engine designer who worked on the Ferrari 125, which Fleming was a big fan of. Of course, Fleming being quite keen on cars. The role that he plays in For Your Eyes Only, there's... As you remember from the film, Christastos kind of befriends Bond early on, and he talks about this smuggler, Columbo, and basically makes Bond think that he's the baddie and he's the one doing drug smuggling and he's the protagonist or the enemy of the film. Later on, he's saved by Columbo and his men, and when he speaks to him, he finds out that Columbo is actually an ally. And although he smuggles in gold, diamonds, cigarettes and pistachio nuts, he doesn't smuggle heroin. And throughout the film, you can see Columbo, he's constantly eating pistachio nuts. That's his thing. Mm. In my research, that crops up a lot. I don't know why. It's just a strange little pointless thing. So, yeah, That's his role in it. He plays quite a big part in the role. He's almost like a kind of, what's the name of the detective guy in Daniel Craig ones, French guy,
Mathis.
So he plays a kind of similar role as Mathis, I think, in that he's an ally of Bond throughout the series, and he plays a big part in actually what happens towards the end of it. But throughout the film, there's question marks about him. Towards they do a raid on Christastos's opium processing warehouse in Albania, and they take control of it, and there's a big fight with Locke, good henchman, and then eventually they together, him and Bond, they climb up to Christastos' mountain retreat, and eventually they kill Christastos. So yeah, he's quite a big role. He's quite an interesting character because he's quite fun. He's quite jovial. He's slightly menacing. He's quite a well-rounded character, and he's definitely one of the best parts of that film. He's quite an important part of that. Apparently, he was cast following a suggestion by Dana, who, as we know, is heavily involved with a lot of the casting throughout the Bond series.
Wait, have you said his name yet?
What, the actor?
Yeah.
No, I don't think I have, no. So he's played by Chaim Topol, who is actually just mainly known as Topol the world over. Most people probably don't even know his first name. And
I'll explain
why that is in a minute. So yeah, let me talk a little bit about Chaim Topol and his career and what he's done. He was born in 1935 in Tel Aviv. He's an Israeli actor, singer, comedian. He does voice work. He does film producing, he's an author, he's an illustrator, does a lot of stuff. Big deal in the Israeli world and the world over, basically. He's best known for his role in Fiddler on the Roof. Have either of you seen Fiddler on the Roof?
No.
I haven't either. He plays Tevi the Dairyman in that, and it's the role that's defined his career, that he's basically he's just associated with that role, because he's not only played it in one place, he's played it in films, he's played it in various different countries, all this stuff, which I'll tell you about in a minute. But he played the role in more than 3,500 times in shows and revivals from the 60s until 2009.
Wow.
His life is basically playing this role. He began his acting career in Israeli army services, and he toured with the theatre company back in those days. He was co-founder of a theatre company called Haifa Theatre. I'm going to talk a lot about films here, or briefly mention films that you'll probably not have heard of, because I haven't. A lot of them are Israeli films, but apparently they're quite big. His breakthrough film role came in 1964as the title character in a film called Salah Shabati, in which he won a Golden Globe for Most Promising Newcomer. And he went on to appear in more than 30 films in Israel and the United States, including Galileo and Flash Gordon. It's one of the few films that he's been in that I know quite a lot about. He was described as Israel's only internationally recognised entertainer from the 1960s through to the 80s. So nobody, there's no other famous people that came from there in that period, or so it was said. He's won lots of awards over his time. He's seen as being quite an impressive actor. In 2015, he was awarded the Israel Prize for Lifetime Achievement in Fiddler in the Roof. So he first played the role of Fiddler in Fiddler in the Roof in 1966 in the Israeli production of it. So Fiddler in the Roof, I think, started in 1964 and it kind of moved around different countries and, you know, how it does with stage shows. And, yeah, 1964. And he was called on to audition for the role in the London, Her Majesty's Theatre in London, even though he wasn't fluent in English. So what he basically did was he memorised the score from listening to the Broadway cast version and just practised the lyrics without knowing the language. So when he auditioned, he was auditioning from memory and not from the fact that he actually understood what the words meant. He was around 30 years old when he auditioned for his original role when he went to audition for this. But the character he was playing is like in his 50s or 60s. So one of the main impressive things that he's done by playing this role is that he manages to really well pull off an old man, even though he's only 30-something. And he explains this and says, a good actor can play an old man, a sad face, a happy man. Makeup is not an obstacle. And yeah, he kind of, that's one of the main reasons he's famous for this role, because he was a young man playing an old character. So so the reason he's known as Topol and not Chaim Topol is because, and I'm not pronouncing Chaim correctly, people couldn't pronounce Chaim. There's actually a way to pronounce Chaim. I think it's the CH at the start actually has an Israeli way of pronouncing it, which I'm not even going to attempt here. So the English producers just started calling him Topol. And it stuck, so everyone just knows him as Topol now. I think he's even referenced in Notting Hill. Not a particularly big reference, but they do talk about Topol and not Chaim Topol. He was, his role in Fiddler on the Roof, in the film version, I think, he was chosen over Danny Kaye, Rod Steiger, Danny Thomas, Walter Matthau, Richard Burton and Frank Sinatra, who all expressed interest in the part. So it's pretty impressive that he got that over all of these massive, big, global acts when he's this Israeli actor. He used a technique of locking his muscles, it says, to convincingly play an old character. And he said at the time, as a young man, I had to make sure that I didn't break the illusion for the audience. You have to tame yourself. I'm now someone who is supposed to be 50, 60 years old. I cannot jump. I cannot suddenly be young. You produce a certain sound in your voice that is not young. So pretty big method acting there. Obviously did a good job with it. I could go on for hours about all the stuff that he did on Fiddler in the Roof.
Can we talk about James Bond?
Well, there's not a lot really to do with James Bond. So he basically he's done loads of other stuff as well. He's got he's got musical credits, so he's done albums and things like that. He's a singer. Topol with Roger Webb in his orchestra. Topol sings Israeli freedom songs, war songs by Topol. Lots of different stuff. He's an author. He's also an illustrator. He's illustrated approximately 25 books in Hebrew and English, which is interesting. And he's also worked on loads of different charity projects. In terms of Bond, there's barely anything I can find about him on Bond, aside from getting his biography. But he's not done any interviews really about every interview he does. If you look up Topol, he's just talking about Fiddler in the Roof. It's all he cares about. It's all anyone interviews him about. If you read any interview with him, like about his life, they mention, as well as being in Bond, then it just goes into this kind of Fiddler in the Roof stuff, and it's all generally about that. So I don't really have a lot of information on any interesting anecdotes around Bond or anything like that.
And Roger never said anything about him.
What?
Roger never said anything about him.
No, there's not a lot about him that isn't. He's essentially just the guy in Fiddler in the Roof.
Yeah, I imagine even Roger just would talk about Fiddler on the Roof if he was to talk about him.
Probably. He'd probably have an anecdote about Fiddler on the Roof. Yeah. So, yeah, I think he's quite a good character in For Your Eyes Only. He's definitely one of the most memorable characters in that film. But, yeah, Chaim Topol.
Well, that's a weird way to end the podcast, but thank you as always for listening. We have a huge, huge special coming up next. Who wants to talk about it?
It's, well, I imagine BJ's not that bothered with this because he's had his Brosnan fill.
Is it Brosnan again? Are we doing it again?
Has he got a middle name we don't know about?
It's Piers Brosnan, here we go again. No, it's Mr. Sean Connery. Sorry, Sir Sean Connery, whose real name is Tommy. Did you know that, Wheatley?
I did not know that.
Big Tam.
His name's not even Sean.
His name's not even Sean.
Oh, what a scam.
But he still comes under C for Connery, so do him. We'll do him next. I imagine it'll be another epic episode, probably a two-parter. But if you do want...
I'm not sure what we're going to get from this. I think with Connery, it's a bit of a tricky one because we know him as Bond and kind of know a lot of stuff that's in the news. But every time I find stuff out about Connery, it's quite interesting because it's stuff that you didn't know. A lot of his life's been quite hidden.
Mm. And he's a very private man, and never written an autobiography.
Yeah.
Very much kept himself to himself and had a very clear idea of keeping his private life private, which is very dignified. And he was the first James Bond, so he's probably one of the most important people we'll get to do an episode on. So I'm really psyched. And I guess if any of our listeners want to chip in any thoughts on Sir Sean, then how can they email us?
Email us at podcast@jamesbond.co.uk. Or you can hit us on the social channels.
Instagram, Facebook, Twitter, @JamesBondA2Z.
Yeah, and thanks to everyone who has been messaging us on social. It's been really good to get your feedback and your messages. I'm glad you've been listening. If you can also leave us a review on the podcast service that you are listening to us right now. Tell all your friends, tell your enemies. James Bond A to Z will return.
Thanks for listening.
Ciao.
The James Bond A to Z podcast features Tom Butler, Brendan Duffy, and Tom Wheatley. The podcast was produced by Tom Wheatley, with music by Tom Ingemels, and artwork supplied by Helen Dolly.
You know how to book flights and hotels. All you're missing is a tool to plan the travel experiences you'll have once you arrive. That's why you need Viator. Book guided tours, activities, excursions, and more in one place to make your trip truly unforgettable. Viator has over 300,000 travel experiences to choose from. Everything from simple tours to extreme adventures and all the niche, interesting stuff in between. So you can plan something that everyone you're traveling with will enjoy. Real traveler reviews give the inside scoop from people who've already been on the experiences you're considering, so you can plan with confidence. Free cancellation helps you plan for the unexpected, and 24/7 customer support means you can travel worry-free. Download the Viator app now and use code Viator10 for 10% off your first booking in the app. Find travel experiences for you. Do more with Viator.
Without the ones like you who work tirelessly to keep things running, everything would suddenly stop. Hospitals, factories, schools, and power plants, they all depend on you. No matter the weather, emergency, or time of day, you're the ones who get it done. At Grainger, we're here for you with professional-grade industrial supplies. Count on real-time product availability and fast delivery. Call, clickgrainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.